rails. The first place in the first construction for the public on which there was no center aisle was Wagner's Festspielhalle in Bayreuth, because Wagner did not believe that people should be able to get out. So, you are the letter day, Now, as far as the reading goes, let me just repeat what I said last time. Please stop getting tribal straight away. In fact, I'll already have today to come to some of it. It doesn't take very long to read. The second will be the Vedekind, which is on reserve in Helen White. The third is the dream, and the fourth is the nature. About section, we shall tell you next time, yes? And about the film, we'll tell you next week as well. So there is no problem. But now please read the culture of Western Europe for a general background. And for a specific discourse, please start reading Jenny Tribal. Your first section, which might or might not come at the end of next week, Dr. Berry, should deal with Jenny Tribal. So please read it at least by then. Now, I said last time that we are starting in a period called the Bundesjahr of the end of the 19th century. That is a period roughly from 1880 to 1914. You can call it, if you like, the end of the 19th century or the beginning of the 20th. It makes no difference, obviously. It is a time of a certain heightened, if you like, dialectic. We call it the Indian summer of the bourgeois world because it was, in a sense, the last flourishing of the bourgeois world. It was, if you like, the last time of a comfortable middle-class bourgeois life which spread up and downward throughout society. I can illustrate it to you perhaps this way. It is a time when, until roughly 1880, even in London, when you talk about the working classes, you're actually talking about servants. Servants outnumbered all other working classes still about the 1880s. And even to 1914, in London there were some 300,000 or 400,000 servant classes. That shows you how comfortable middle-class life was. Don't look at me that way. These days I have to vote in Good Earth or some villages outside town. But in those days, a great deal of the London population was servant class. But on the other hand, it is, of course, also the time of the first total attack on the bourgeois age, the revolt against the bourgeois age, out of which, as I said last time, a modern culture came. Now, this dialectic is at least partly due to the fact that throughout the whole of the 19th century, what had previously been taken for granted was questioned. That indeed the whole of the 19th century is part of what is called the industrialization of Europe, which you would call in modern jargon, Europe becoming from an underdeveloped to a developed continent, at least Central and Western Europe. Eastern Europe doesn't become developed. Well, isn't that even yet? So what you have, therefore, Western and Central Europe become a developed continent. And the accompanying of this industrialization is, of course, a new feeling of movement, a new restlessness, which you get from the beginning of the 19th century, and which is, of course, heightened in that communications revolution, about which I'll talk to you eventually, the telephone, the railroad, all these things that come at the end of the century. But if you ever read Sir Walter Scott, which none of you does anymore, and if you read his introduction to the Waverley novels of about 1812, you will find there a striking passage which goes somewhat like this. where there were fields, there were factories. Where there was loneliness, there are crowds. In other words, even Sir Walter Scott in 1812 realized very much that there was a change towards industrialization. And part of the vogue of his historical novels are connected of that change. Romanticism was, in a way, an escape from what many romantics, like Sir Walter Scott, realized what was happening. They fled into Sherwood Forest. They fled into their life, into their world of knights and ladies and the Middle Ages. There are many other examples. For example, the first novel about bourgeois life in Germany, which comes in 1840. The title I won't bother you with, it's Hackländer's Wandel und Handel. The content of this first novel about bourgeois life is as follows, that the bourgeois merchant goes insane because he travels too much. I shall come back to that, because our age will be the first age of mass tourism. He gets out of his village, he travels, he loses his roots, he goes insane. And that is why you have, of course, in the 19th century, that desperate searching for roots, flourishing of nationalism, because all nationalism is a search for roots. And while in the 18th century, the European elite hadn't quite a dare for roots, now you get this horrible search for ancestor, that ancestor worship, yes? Which comes, of course, again, with the new industrialization, with the new bourgeois society, and the restlessness. And that restlessness, after all, you can see in another way, which also goes into our period, into Jenny Trimer. The constant emphasis on restraint. Restraint is good, excess is bad. Now that becomes the cause of the essence of bourgeois life and bourgeois society. It was not always so. And it is, of course, exemplified in two ways which will concern us very much indeed. It is exemplified in the idea of beauty, the Greek idea of beauty. Beauty is harmony. That is in Hegel, but it comes in the classical revival of the 18th century. So that the whole European concept of beauty is one of restraint, whether it is the nation, which symbolizes itself by Greek temples, the capital in Wisconsin or in Washington have a long tradition, the nation, which are Greek temples, or your own idea of what is a beautiful man or a beautiful woman. He is harmonious, he is proportionate, he is as close to Greek sculpture as possible. You all who flunk, of course, your hair, you all. Together with this, you get there, of course, quite clearly the idea, a new idea of beauty which will occupy it. A Greek idea of beauty through which the nation represents itself. An idea of stereotype, which becomes very important for racism and nationalism and indeed everything. For this dialectic, how does it exemplify itself? How does it hit people? How does it hit people? How does it hit people's perception? It hits people, nobody ever asks that. How does it hit people's perception? It hits people's perception, not through factories, which people don't really see, not through slums, which are away from the places most articulate people as yet live in the 19th century. It hits them through a sense of the rush of time, through a change of time. That you must always remember. Because we even have a saying, that time moves slower in the country than in the city. And when you go out to the woods of Wisconsin, as I know some of you do, you feel relaxed. You say, oh, time moves slowly here. Well, it doesn't, because if it's 12 o'clock in Baraboo, it's 12 o'clock in central Milwaukee. But the perceptions in Baraboo and Milwaukee are obviously quite different, right? Or your perception. So, it is the rush of time. That means travel. That means generally nervous. And here we already have one of the words which will constantly come back. God is afraid of the women. Afraid, therefore, of his death. Restraint is necessary to face the new rush of time so that the virgin will not go crazy through traveling, so that the uprooting can be overcome in a kind of rootedness. So that in all of this, the effects of becoming a developed country, the effects of industrialization, are an emphasis on restraint, and it goes so far as to affect European and American ideas of beauty, standards of beauty and standards of ugliness. It goes into all philosophy. There's always an attempt to seek rest. There's always an attempt to seek restfulness of regret. The greatest philosophical example, I would say that, for those of you at 5:13, is Hegel. Hegel, who at one time has his dialectic, which is always moving and never ends, but secondly, his ideal, which expresses itself ever more through the dialectic. So that you have in Hegel, typically enough, at the very beginning of the 19th century, already this idea of movement and the idea of a resting point. Now clearly, within all of this, all ideas were questioned more and more. And you can say, I think, up to the French Revolution, without much doubt, that a sort of consensus existed in Europe. Monarchy was the best form of government. Few people doubted that. God and Christ existed. Religion was not much in dispute. Everybody believed in God and Christ. There were just variations, but everybody believed in them anyhow. So then you have a basic kind of consensus about government and ideology, up at least to the French Revolution and the industrialization. Oh yes, there were screwballs, I've written about them, some idiots here and there in the long dark. But by and large, everybody had a consensus. Such a consensus will never exist again. That monarchy is a good form of government, and that Christianity is true. That is, the sacrifice and resurrection of Christ are the fundamental things. Actually, everybody still believes that today, to really take a poll of the mass, even today, I think. But it's been overlaid with all sorts of other things. So, we should come back to that, because even today, the fastest growing churches are the fundamentalist Christian churches. They are probably all that will remain of Christianity eventually. So, that what you have here, then it's clear, you have a consensus. Now that consensus is distraught. Look at all the question a good middle class person like John Stuart Mill asks in the middle of the 19th century. John Stuart Mill, not a screwball at all, but a member of the establishment, good bourgeois. Is there a God, or is there not? What is Christianity? Have we the power of moral choice at all? Are we automatons or not? Is man simply a higher aim? In other words, there is profound doubt here. And though you can trace that doubt to Bale in the 17th century and even to Pascal, there nevertheless, there is a new kind of doubt, a doubt of everything, a doubt which denies it's really the most fundamental, whether man is man, whether he isn't just an ape. Whether we have moral choices or we don't have moral choices. Christianity. In other words, ideology became unstuck. Now that's one thing that happened. And so you can see that there have to be things that make up to it. Ideas of restraint. Ideas of beauty. And of course, I forgot. The one thing that symbolized bourgeois society to everyone. To everyone. Manners and morals. In other words, don't forget that the time of the rush of time is also the beginning of modern morality. It's the beginning of the shame of the body. It's the beginning of what we would call middle class morality. You would read about it. It comes at the same time. Because the emphasis on this morality is also of control. It came about not just because of the rush on time. It came about because of a Christian revival. Above all, because of a Christian revival. But it also has to do with the rush of time. It also has to do with restraint, because that is what modern manners and morals, exemplify. They exemplify this restraint. So that I will tell you one story, and then I will leave this, because you can read about it in the culture of Western Europe. As I always like to say, when you sat next to a lady in 1780 at a dinner party, and you did not reach in to her bosom and fondle her breast, you were never asked back again. But if you did this as early as 1810, you were never asked back again. In other words, the change is very rapid. The change is very rapid. And its restraint, which under the influence of Christianity, of this Christian revival, becomes shame. For example, many years ago, we were born as librarians to the Earl of Leicester in England. And in his dining room, there was still a cupboard with his piss pots. The Duke and the Duchess were inscribed on it. And unlearned, you pissed whenever you damn well felt like it. Everybody had his piss pots, including the guests, you see. Now, within about 80 years, this vanishes. And you get a shame of your natural function. A shame of the body, which did not exist. And which is, of course, part of the rebellion we are talking about will rebel again. But this shame of the body is the tip of the iceberg. And manners and morals become very important. In Jenny Tribal, they are very important. They are the glue that holds together bourgeois society. And therefore, appearance becomes very important. To get rest, to get orientation, to get restraint in the rush of time. And that is why, my dears, if you ever go today to the state of Singapore, would my wonderful dictator, and I mean an excellent dictator, Mr. Yi, if you have long hair, he will cut it off to you at the frontier, because long hairs mean strength. In other words, appearance and behavior become very closely linked, of course. That's why many of you, I'm sure, wear long hair to annoy your parents. But the question is that you have, therefore, this idea of appearance and behavior and restraint. That is, again, a matter of perception. And that is why so much you will read of the revolt, Vedicate, with its scene of masturbation. Come to masturbation at length. Masturbation is, in a way, a test point of all of this. A bourgeois a restraint, because from 1870 on, Dr. Tissot's tract on masturbation tells you that if you masturbate, you will lose your brain, you will go insane. He has a list of about 60 things, which you all know is nonsense today. But you already get it makes you nervous. At the beginning, masturbation is to somebody like Tissot what railway travel will be for Max Nordau later. It's a matter which ruins your nerves, which makes you nervous, and therefore a menace to bourgeois society, and a menace to a bourgeois culture. Yes? There's one way I must tell you this. There's a one. Tissot has another wonderful thing which will please the Marxist among you. He says, you shouldn't masturbate, because masturbation is like throwing money out of the window. You're wasting, you see. As a good capitalist, you shouldn't. So, what you have therefore here is this constant idea of restraint. Now, first of all, ideology was becoming unglued. John Stuart Mill questioned things which the limits were narrow before, but not now. And as a result, the reaction in Frau Jenny Tribal and so on is also there. And second of all, of course, the whole nexus of culture changed. But first of all, about the first, and I forgot, I want to read you a passage of Le Bon's The Crowd, because he reflects this and so many. You see, Le Bon himself says that in 1892, at the present day, as a result of discussion and analysis, all opinions are losing their prestige. their damned features are rapidly worn away, and few survive capable of arousing enthusiasm. Le Bon there writes on your page 153 of the crowd. His answer is, of course, we're in the age of crowds. So we have to make a basic adjustment, as you will see. But this is generally true. Now, at the same time, of course, the nexus of culture was changing as well, still more confusing. If up to the French Revolution there had been a consensus, yes, on monarchy, on Christianity, you can also say that at that time, court culture and patronage dominated. I mean, other classes had no cultural function, yes? The kids always used to ask me during our revolutions, you know, why don't you talk about the peasants, you snob? I'm snob. You're quite justified in not talking about that. But I used to tell them, all we know about the peasants is that they plowed and copulated, and I can't make a lecture on them. So, in other words, what we have here really is that culture is court culture. Court culture, patronage. And at the beginning of the 19th century, that broadens, but not really very much. It broadens to middle class culture. But at first, it broadens to what we might call the high middle class. At the beginning of the 19th century, what we call the salons, or the drawing rooms, certain drawing rooms of Berlin and Paris and Vienna, is where the elite met, and the cultural elite was well defined. Moses Mendelssohn's daughter, Dorothea Mendelssohn, married most of them one after another. So they weren't that big, yes? And they all met in these drawing rooms, the drawing rooms of Rachel Levine in Berlin, or of others in Vienna, I won't bother you. They all met in these drawing rooms. But obviously that wasn't going to last. And so you get really the beginning of mass culture and the diffusion of culture. Now that was here very much. Perhaps the best example I can give you here is very simple. If you ever read that, the city, you'll never read it anyhow. Goethe's Faust, part 2, 1799, starts out with a startling passage. The passage is as follows. In 1799, Goethe writes, what is the future of art? Art can have no future. Because what is happening? People are coming into the theater with a newspaper of their pockets. So if we can get the news day by day, there is no time for thought. There is no time for rest. There is no time for art. There is no time for culture. So Faust II is probably the last cultural thing that would ever be written. So this startling passage in Goethe's Faust illustrates that there was a sense of a fear of mass culture. Because mass culture is, of course, restless. And yet, of course, that fear was greatly misplaced. Because while the cultural nexus broadens, it broadens only to what we might call a more diffuse intellectual elite. That is to say, we will still be dealing with an intellectual elite. It is no longer, if you like, only clergymen, court society, or those who do not have to work, rentiers. Though it's a lot of rentiers, those who clip coupons today, those who do not have to work. Obviously, culture rests a lot on the rentiers, and still, but it also now includes the professional life. The teacher, if you like, the lawyer, the doctor, and we must also say the politician, because a politician in Europe is still apt to be a lawyer, teacher, doctor, or professor. So that there is still a cultural elite when we deal with anything. We deal with the cultural elite, but it is much broader. And it is more diversified. Paper is cheap now, very cheap. So you can print anything you like. You don't need much money to start a journal. You don't need much money to print a book. So that you get a cultural explosion. And if you look at the people who made it, they are still the same people. Now why? Because popular culture tends to be extremely static. That is to say, it doesn't change much, ever. I dare say from the beginning of the 19th century to today, popular culture is the same in its large object. You can say that popular culture is sentimental culture. You can say that it is a culture of a very expressed utopia. What is this fairy tale? I can never an Aschenbüttel in German, you know, the scullery maid who comes to Princeton. What?
Cinderella.
Ah, Cinderella. The Cinderella. The fairy tale. The love of hierarchy, and clarity and hierarchy, and very often the tolerance, I shall talk to you at length about it later, the tolerance of popular culture, the relative tolerance, which you get in Germany, for example, but always still Renaissance comedy, if there is comedy, the comedy that lasted, the old style comedy, all of it. And there is, of course, a reason for it. High culture penetrates downward only very slowly, if at all. It's something that we have to talk about before the age of television, of course, we'll come. And even in the age of television. It penetrates down only very slowly. The reading of mass culture tends to be narcotic. It doesn't want too much excitement, but it wants a certain ideal picture. It wants hope. And as hope in class society is very much barred, it's hope that is sentimentalized. In the Cinderella story, if you have a good heart, you will make it. If you have a good heart, you will marry the prince and live like Jenny Tribe. But you have to have a good heart. In other words, hierarchy was very deeply among the lower classes. It's utter nonsense to say it wasn't. That's a bit of untrue socialism. They didn't as yet have consciousness, I might use that, at all. Especially domestic servants were loyal to their masters, thought of themselves as part of their family. And they were not about to read revolutionary tracts. They were usually more conservative than the master, if anything. So what you have, therefore, here is a conservative popular culture. As somebody wrote, it's unchanged. The need of a scullery maid to dream that she will someday marry the Duke is a basic pattern that hardly varies. Even in an age when scullery maids are dying out and dukes are transformed into tourist guides of their stately homes. All this is, of course, quite true. It varies very, very little, because in a way its rhythm is built in. It's narcotic, it's sentimental, it gives hope, it's hierarchical. There is no socialist popular literature, something that hardly exists, by the way. We shall come later why that should be, but there hardly is that. So that popular literature is always a fairy. And fairy tales don't vanish. That is the nature of fairy tales, isn't it? If they were changed, if the fairy suddenly had yellow slippers, she would not be convincing. She had to have gold slippers. And if she didn't have blonde hair, she wouldn't be convincing either. So that you have these stereotypes, very strong in popular culture. But self-education is beginning. There is the self-educated worker, and he becomes always more important from the beginning of the 19th century. And by the time we start, we have an embryonic workers' education movement. Only embryonic, which goes much stronger, but which somehow in the end doesn't change mass reading habits either. Doesn't change mass reading habits, they are not changed today. It's interesting, as I referred to you, you can't talk today about a class television. Everybody sits before the same program. Duchess and scullery maid and in between, yes? sit in front of Kutak or whatever is the situation comedy of the hour, you see. In other words, mass culture triumphs, but it triumphs as mass culture. It doesn't triumph as higher culture at all. So what you have, therefore, is a certain rhythm, which we shall contest, but which we shall have, after all, to discuss. Now, this broadening of cultural nexus, this broadening of the arena in which culture takes place, of course, makes for a yearning for elitism. This is, after all, what the Art for Arts movement is about. Oscar Wilde, Matthew Arnold, We Happy Few. It makes for the new aesthetic, for a yearning of an elitism, which you still find in many English departments above all. This kind of yearning, that there should be an authority for culture, and that we must be the authority. Well, it's harmless, because it doesn't work. You have the ridiculous writings of Matthew Arnold, people like that, who set themselves up as the arbiters of culture. There's a lot of that in that, and there's a lot of that in Jenny Trident as well. We have it too, we grew, we arbiter of culture. That what we do is so tasty. And that, of course, goes hand in hand with respectability, with manners. Now, this is very important, because it has a direct bearing on your Fontana reading. When you read Fontana's Jenny Trident, you will find two things interlocked. The tribals, rich, middle class, set themselves up as authority of manners, of how things are done. Things are done right. They're not done wrong. And there is one way of doing right. Yes? Which is beyond that we all accept. I mean, we all accept now, which very few people would have accepted, of course, in an earlier age, that we use a knife and fork and not our fingers for some reason. We all accept that because our ancestors were not perfectly healthy people for all that. But this goes beyond the base. You have to set the table next. Yes, as you know, as you probably don't know anymore, a knife and fork must be on your leg when you set a table. Yes? Or am I getting it right? We always have circles, so I've never had a problem. But now I don't bother about it anyhow. But a knife and fork must be on the leg and so on. In other words, manner, how to do things, as the second standard in general tribal, is the furniture. The way the house is furnished. We'll talk about this at some length. This also is a furniture of security. What you call Victorian furniture. In Germany, you call it Biedermeier. Victorian furniture. This kind of furniture also gives you a good resting place. It's much better than modern furniture. You sink into it, yes? And there you are. And you don't sit on a piece of furniture. You see, there is such a thing. When we talk about radical chic, we are really talking about people who want to set themselves up as authorities in a culture which is the future, yes? I mean, you have radical chic in academia. You know, when I go to my colleagues, I have to sit on uncomfortable chairs, because that's modern chairs, yes? Well, I have to look at African sculpture, they don't care about it, but it's in. Well, you have the same sort of thing, yes? You have these in things. Now, you mustn't forget that's rather new. Before the French Revolution, 19th century, what was in was what the court did. You did what the court did. But now, all sorts of things are in, yes? There's a wide thing, and there are always people who set themselves up as the authority. That is one reaction, and in Jenny Trident, it is quite clear. For what is needed always is standards. What is needed is, after all, a standard. Now, having said all of this in a general way, it must be clear that the bourgeois world continues into the end of the century with the manners and attitudes it acquired at the beginning of the 19th century, with the French Revolution, with industrialization, with the rapid change of time, and all that means. And the bourgeois lifestyle is by that time settled. It is settled as a lifestyle, And as you will see, as a philosophy of positivism, it becomes ever more pronounced, as if you like, ever more, if you like, defensive. This bourgeois lifestyle, ever more besieged, emphasized in the attack against it by Dedekind, by G, by all of these people, by Oscar Wilde, in the attacks against it by the workers, by the strikes, by the restless politics, by the first mass movement. By the way, for the new ones, I tell you, I mean, you must know the politics a little bit. I'm not going to talk about it. But the change in politics, the change, the social change, in all of this, it emphasizes a lifestyle. And that lifestyle is a totality. It's Martin Menes, moral furniture. Why do you look at me all that way with your big eyes? Isn't that the same in Fox Point today or in wherever suburb you may come from? No. I'm just telling you now what you must all know. I'm talking about the house of your parents, probably. I should have thought so in large degree. Anyway, this foible about cleanliness. Yeah, well. Anyway, this is a special American problem. In America, by Heidrich, anyhow. Anyhow, what you have there is now synthesized, if you like, in a certain lifestyle, which is apt to reject nonconformity as threatening, even if it is nonconformity in lifestyle. Well, I'm trying to be clear to you. Except for the aristocracy, it can always take more. It's better than the bourgeoisie. So in Proust, the Duke of Guermantes, they tolerate the homosexual, the Duke of Charlus, and they tolerate the Jew. But Jews and homosexuals are eccentricities, and it depends how much you can tolerate eccentricity, then you can tolerate Jews and homosexuals. If you don't tolerate eccentricity, then you can do without them. At the same time, imagination is, after all, condemned for clarity, hard work, and survival. The best summary comes from a book about which we shall talk at length later, which is in a way a breviary of bourgeois attitudes. It is the philosophy behind Jenny Tribe, Max Nordau's famous Degeneration, which is directed against modern art, literature, everything that's modern, from 1892, directed against everything that's modern. It's sort of the philosophical accompaniment to General Tribe, Max Nordau, and Degeneration. And he puts it this way. Modern art and modern literature are a threat because they symbolize, he tells us, outworn nerves. It all comes down always to medical theories. You see that. Outworn nerves. People's nerves are worn. What by? The railroads. Come to that. And the changes in perception, you're right. Anyway, so to modern art and literature, he says, the normal man. And I quote now, men upon whom human progress depends. Now listen carefully. Those who rise early and are not weary before sunset. Those who have clear heads, solid stomachs, and hard muscles. The ideal of every dowager of the Bronx and elsewhere, I guess. I read it to you again, it may be so strange to you. Those who rise early and are not weary before sunset, who have clear heads, solid stomachs, and hard muscles. Anybody want to volunteer? No. Anyhow, now, this is the description of a lifestyle, which may be familiar to you, but which is new, original, new, and now in the defensive. And in a way you can, from your own life, see how much you triumph or not. From your own parents you can see how much you triumph or not. I may make fun of it, or one is always in the temptation of making fun of it, but of course I am a perfect example. If I have any children, which thank God I don't, because always a risk in bed, I think. The question is still, that's the kind of China we like to care for. No? Anybody admit to you that that's you have children, that's the kind of children you want?
No,
that's in China. I'm going to privately with you. Anyhow, no, that then is the life. And it is heightened here. This is the tendon to Jenny Tribal. So remember one thing. Jenny Tribal is mortal. This is the upper bourgeois, the rich bourgeois. Max Nordau is the newly arrived bourgeois. But he himself typified it, as we can see. He wrote 12 novels, all bad, 12 books of essays. He was a practicing doctor. He founded the Zionist movement, or one of the founders believe in it, but he founded it just to have an outlet for his activities. He himself, he fathered, I think, 8 children, he had a wife, and he did that. And of course, for women, this is all very bad. You see, this is all men. He would never have thought of anything else. We should come back to that, of course, as well. Now, all of this said, I think I have made it clear, or I hope I have made it clear, that we have a bourgeois lifestyle and the revolt again. The years 1880 to 1914 are the climax of the bourgeois world and the reaction against it. The life of the settled bourgeois, its manners and morals and respectability, which had spread to all classes. The working classes are more prudish in the end than anyone else. The working classes, as you know, are more prudish than anything you could imagine. In other words, this lifestyle spread to the working class. It was embraced by the working class as a way up the rung of the ladder. And today still, don't go to a German working class quarter with long hair, see what happens to you. In other words, today it spread to the working classes, of course. It spread upwards and downwards. But still, there is in the midst of all this unrest still a feeling of security, of progress, and economics. Remember one other thing. This age was the age of the problem. Between 1880 and 1914, most of the great modern fortunes of Europe were made. This is the age of the problem. This is when most of the great modern fortunes were made. Or, indeed, in German, we call it the age of the common. But in France, too, it's the age of the common. So, there was security, there was success, there was progress. Please don't forget that. If I can be personal again, my grandfather came to Berlin in 1863 as one of 13 children of a poor Prussian doctor who had been most of the time in prison for helping the Poles against the Prussians. Poor men, they came to Berlin. And of these 13 children, by the time they died in 1923, 3 were multimillionaires in gold markets. A multimillionaire. One had written the Japanese Constitution. Another had been the president of the Prussian Supreme Court. In other words, I just tell you this to show you that is an age when advance was possible. That is an age when many people did advance. So that you mustn't overestimate the insecurity. That is the age of the founders. This example that I gave you can be mentioned in America by the Carnegies and the Mellons and God knows what. And in France too, by the Coisers and the Schneiders. There are many examples. I won't bother you with them, but you must remember. But it is in this age that you get, after all, the first mass movement. It was the Boulangist movement in France, which Le Bon described. We'll come back to it. The first mass movement. It is in that age you get the first mass strike. It is in that age, above all, that you get the revolt of youth against the elders, which attack the very linchpins of bourgeois security, manners and morals and the way of life. To many of the bourgeois, the attacks by people like Wedekind and others were more painful than the attacks by the striking workers. the striking workers who shot down. I mean, the one of course is very uninteresting. Striking workers who shot down. And what did you do with your own children? I know that doesn't matter. In other words, coming from within, this was, in a sense, of course, a much more deeper attack, and realized by the bourgeoisie, a much more deeper attack, because not only attack on the economics of the situation, of the politics, but a cultural revolution, an attack on their very lifestyle, and from the very lifestyle wherein. So, that in an attack were all the movements we call the avant-garde, expressionism, futurism, revolt against their elders, all these plays about murdering one's father, to which we shall soon come, new concepts of youth and vigor, all of that, that sort of thing, must be clear. Whether it was a play within a play, we shall examine eventually. But this revolt, of course, had lasting effects. Discovery of the unconscious, Freud, would be unthinkable without Freud, Jung, and all of psychoanalysis. The relative tolerance of modern manners, I think, would be unthinkable without it. And above all, modern literature and modern art would, of course, be unthinkable about it. And without it, it's the beginning of abstractionist art, and it's the beginning of modern literature as well. And of course, in the end, it's all put together by Nietzsche, who attacks the lifestyle, art, literature, politics, and everything in the most fundamental way it has ever, I think, been done anywhere. But first, then, we must understand the world that these people reacted against, and that world is the world of genuine pride. So what I want to do on Monday is I want to talk a little bit about genuine pride. Actually, I can only say very little because the book is so self-explanatory. It'll be much more interesting if on Monday already I ask you if you have any questions about it. If there's anything that strikes you straight, and you will, of course, do it in the discussion as well. But it's a little difficult for me to discuss because I think you may not agree, as you tell me on Monday, that it is the most self-explanatory book in the world. So that I want to talk about any problem and then get into the communication very soon.